Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have the third annual African Presidential Roundtable Public Forum, hosted by Boston University's African Presidential Archives and Research Center. This year's symposium featured former African heads of state discussing a range of issues impacting U.S.-Africa relations and followed closed-door talks on the subjects. Introducing the participants and moderating tonight's discussion is longtime Boston TV news anchor Liz Walker.
I'd like to begin by giving you a brief biographical sketch of each of our panelists. His Excellency Pierre Buyoya, the Republic of Burundi, served two terms as President of Burundi, the first from 1987 to 1993, and the second from 1996 to 2003. In the interim, between his presidential terms, he created and served as head of the Foundation for Unity, Peace, and Democracy, a nonprofit organization dedicated to studying the institutional, judicial, and security systems of Burundi and issues related to peace and reconciliation in Burundi. He was recently appointed visiting senior fellow at the Watson Institute of Brown University until December 2005. His Excellency Sir Hugh Ketomil Masiri, Republic of Botswana, co-founded the Botswana Democratic Party and served as president from 1980 to 1998. During his tenure, he was chair of the Southern African Development Community and now co-chairs the Global Coalition for Africa. He was knighted in 1991. President Masiri is the current Balfour African President in Residence at Boston University's African Presidential Archives and Research Center. His Excellency Flight Lieutenant Jerry J. Rawlings, Republic of Ghana, directed the destiny of Ghana for nearly 20 years. He was the first elected president of Ghana in the 1992 presidential elections and was reelected in December 1996. Throughout his presidency, he retained his rank as flight lieutenant in the Ghanaian Armed Forces. His Excellency Carl August Offman, Republic of Mauritius, began his political career in 1976 when he served successfully as Minister of Economic Planning and Development in 1983, Minister of Local Government and Cooperatives from 1984 to 1986, Minister of Social Security, National Solidarity, and Reform Institutions from 1988 to 1991, and as Government Chief Whip from 1998 to 1991. President Offman then went on to serve as president of the Movement Socialist Militant Party from 1996 until 2000. President Offman served as the second Balfour African President in Residence here at Boston University's African Presidential Archives and Research Center. His Excellency Joaquim Alberto Chissano of the Republic of Mozambique, on September 20, 1974, at the age of 35, Joaquim Chissano took office as Prime Minister of the transitional government that led Mozambique to the proclamation of its national independence on June 25, 1975, and was subsequently named Minister of Foreign Affairs. With the tragic death of President Samora Machel in 1986, Joaquim Chissano was elected President of the People's Republic of Mozambique. In 1994, he won the first multi-party elections in the history of the country and was re-elected President of the Republic in 1999. In July of 2003, he was elected President of the African Union. Chissano completed his term as President and stepped down in December 2004. His Excellency Ali Hassan Mwinyi, United Republic of Tanzania, was first elected President of Tanzania in November 1985 and re-elected to another five-year term in 1990. He initiated Tanzania's political transition to a multi-party state. Under the terms of Tanzania's constitution, Mwinyi was barred from seeking a third term and completed his presidency in 1995 following Tanzania's first multi-party elections. His Excellency Kenneth David Kaunda, Republic of Zambia, led Zambia to independence and served as the first president of the Republic of Zambia from 1964 to 1991. In addition to his efforts in Zambia, Dr. Kaunda was in the forefront of the efforts to liberate all of Africa, serving as the president of the Pan-African Freedom Movement for East, Central, and Southern Africa in 1962 and chair of the Organization of African Unity from 1970 to 1973. President Kaunda was the first Lloyd G. Balfour African President in Residence at Boston University's African Presidential Archives and Research Center. So, ladies and gentlemen, once again, let us welcome our distinguished panel. I'm going to start this evening with a few questions to our panel. And after that, there will be a half-hour question and answer session in which you can participate. We have a microphone set up for you here. So without further ado, let me pose the first question to all of you. But Your Excellency President Messiri, I'll ask you first to take this question. You all have just met in Johannesburg, I understand, where you were briefed on information from the Commission for Africa, a set of recommendations to participate or precipitate Africa's full participation in global economy. You've also been hearing of briefings about the Millennium Development Goals from the UN. After all of this information that you've received, how hopeful are you that Africa will realize its full potential?
I think your question is a good question. These are some of the developments which we have been awaiting. You will know that after the at the end of the Cold War, there were changes in Africa. There was a democratization. There was an opening of the markets. Economies at the time were all having negative growth rates. Now almost all economies are having, in Africa, are having positive growth rates. And the African, the OAU has converted itself into the African Union. And the African Union has come up with a political-economic program called NAPAD that is development, which aims at the development of Africa politically and economically. And it is emphasizing the fact that the Africans must make an attempt to lift themselves up with their own bootstraps. And in the process of doing so, they, of course, need help from those who have the wherewithal, because modern history has shown that if people do attempt to do things on them for themselves, other people do take courage to help them. And so the Blair Report Commission report, as well as the Millennium Goals, give us great hopes that not only are we trying to improve ourselves, but there are prospects that other people who have the means will also help us to help ourselves.
Your Excellency, President Chissano, could you answer that question for us as well?
Apart from what President Masire said, I would like to say that the Millennium Development Goals are of a big importance, for they were a decision, a unanimous decision by the leaders of the world to try and combat absolute poverty in a very short period. But it seems that we still have to discuss a lot on the implementation, because the efforts which are being deployed are not sufficient to make us reach the targets on time. It is by 2015. Africa is doing very well, but the North, the industrialized North, is doing very little. There are countries who are delivering, but the most powerful ones are not delivering enough. They have promised to contribute with 0.7% of their GDP for aid to development, but they are very short of their promises. Some don't reach 0.3%. Of course, there are some who are beyond the 0.7, but very few, especially the Nordic countries. So the challenges are very big. It's our role to try and convince people that these goals may be achieved, still may be achieved. That's why in September there will be a review of the work done since the year 2000. The leaders of the world will meet again at the United Nations. But this requires the attention not only of the leaders, but also the great public, because the citizens, the taxpayers, are the ones who must actually understand the thing, that when they allow their governments, through their parliaments, through their Congress, to help the poor, they are also helping themselves. They are preparing their better life themselves. It's something which cannot be seen directly. But in the United States of America, people should understand, after the September 11, and after seeing what is happening around the world, the consequences of poverty, they must know that they may become that island of wealth, but encircled by a sea, an ocean of poverty. How can this island survive? I think that if the world is not helping to change the imbalance, if the world accepts this kind of globalization, the world is destroying itself. It will destroy not only the environment, but it will destroy the very human being, all the resources, human resources, which we have. So development in America or in France or in Britain will become meaningless if the rest of the world continues to be treated as it is treated. We must fight for equality. We cannot in the United States speak about equality, about democracy, if there is no participation of all in the benefits of what science brought. Science was not built by one man. Science comes from everywhere, comes from Africa indeed. Science, engineering, and whatnot. So we have to share knowledge. And this is the way of fighting poverty, of reaching the millennium goals, is through investment. There are lots of people who have to invest. There's no excuse for Americans not to invest in Africa. There's no excuse. They have to invest in order to help the countries to do good things. You cannot just claim that we should do better, we should do good things, we should respect human rights. How? There are lots of things which ought to be done. With poverty, it's very difficult to do. So I thank you because the others are going to talk.
Thank you. Certainly a couple of the factors that would pose serious risks to that kind of stability that you speak of would be conflict and civil war. And in this country, that's what we hear about. That's what the media tells us about in Sudan, in the Congo, and many other countries in Africa, of the violence. How can we get past that? And I'll open this question to any of you gentlemen. Is that a public relations problem? Is that a problem that Africa has to handle itself before we can get this global stability that Africa can participate in? Can I ask you, Your Excellency Buyoya?
Yes, I think it's first a question of communication. It's true that we have still conflict in Africa. In the country you have just said, but also in other country, in my country, Burundi. But I think the Western world, and especially the United States, doesn't have the true image of those conflicts. This country went through civil war, through conflict. Europe went through civil wars. Just recently in Bosnia, we have had civil wars. Then civil wars or other kind of wars is not African fatality. It's a human phenomena. Then I think there is a need to have a good communication about those conflicts in Africa. Africa is a young continent. My country, Burundi, is only 40 years old of independence. Then we are still seeking stability. And on the way of seeking stability, you have civil war, you have a conflict. But I think we have to capture what means those conflict, what kind of conflict we have. Second, I think African country, it's our responsibility to deal with those conflicts and to create conditions for investment, first for local investment and then for foreign investment. And NEPAD has to do with the conflict resolution. One, the key element of NEPAD is to say that if we want Africa to develop, we have first to be able to create condition of peace and stability. Mm-hmm. Of course, you don't create peace and stability from one day to another. But now Africa is developing the capacity of conflict resolution. Of course, we need here two assistance of United Nations, assistance of other countries of the world. But if we consider history, how conflict have developed in Europe, have developed in this country, in Asia, we can't say that Africa is exception. Then, in summary, I think we have to create a communication, and here it maybe is also our responsibility, showing that, yes, there is still wars and conflict in Africa, but we are developing also the capacity to solve them. And this is no obstacle for development.
Thank you. Thank you. President Rawlings, we've talked a little bit about the African Union. Given the AU's intervention in Togo to force an election after the death of its long-term president, does this give us a glimpse of the future potential role of the African Union? How do you look at the African Union's effectiveness in the future?
Thank you. Maybe I'd like to just make one or two comments on my
please,
brothers.
Please.
I don't know how well acquainted you are with the what we used to call the Cold War between the East and the West until recently, until the collapse of the Eastern Bloc. We in Africa in the Third World were not suffering from the Cold War that existed between you. We were suffering from the Hot War. Yes. And in other words, the ideological battles were transferred into places like Africa, multinational corporations, as well as the diametrically opposed ideological, whatever they were fighting for their own vested interest. And we were the victims in the process. And now that, of course, and we've paid a very serious price for it, with the demise, or the so-called demise of the Eastern Bloc, now the fight is, I think, is going to be between, let's say, between Europe and the U.S., you know, Britain on the, you know, on the appendage of the U.S., and well, as a politician, I'm not supposed to be saying some of these things, but quite frankly, I have nothing to lose. Some people are politicians, but some of us are patriots. And so it hasn't been quite easy for us. And it's been a very difficult situation. And now that Western multi-party democracy is being inflicted on some of us, and there are those who need... No, when I say inflicted on some of us, in my country, for instance, we've had a taste of multi-party democracy, we've had socialist system, we've had the capitalist system, we've had the one-party system, we've had the coups. None of them were accountable to our people till we had the revolt of 1979. You know, and the price, you know, generals had to pay for it. And, but let's say we're still fumbling and working our way out. And quite frankly, we're learning our lessons and we've come a long way. And the necessary stability is coming to the continent. And I think we're beginning to enjoy the confidence of our own sense of nationalism. And I believe the outside world is beginning to wake up to the potential of our continent. However, there are still a few gray areas and black spots that create a problem for us. The ECOWAS community described the question you just asked me about Togo not too long ago as a coup d'etat by the young man who took over from his late father. In my opinion, It was not a coup d'etat. The coup d'etat took place 38 years ago. And the father dismantled the national army. You know, we have various tribes in Africa, and ended up building an ethnic army. 90-something% of soldiers and officers were from his own tribe. So in effect, he was able to consolidate himself and stayed in power for that long. I hope Chirac and France, well, it's not just Chirac, but France will not be too angry at me. But, I mean, these are some of the colonial old masters who watched this kind of development, and they should have known where it was going to end up, that it would end up in a one-party, you know, dictatorial regime. And yet, they watched it happen to the detriment of other ethnic groups. With his demise, it gives us a fine opportunity, not just those of us within the ECOWAS community. We have our limitations. But quite frankly, if America is serious about wanting to see true democracy, you know, to be nurtured in Africa, if the European Union wants to see that, and France also wants to see that, they should use this opportunity to open a new page in that country. However, let me say something very interesting. Those of you in America may not realize the effect of some of these things on us here, those of us in the third world. President Bush, I knew his father, the first President Bush. Very good man, good friend of mine, when we're both in office. And when his son emerged as your next president, of course, this is America. It's a democratic country, if you have the means. And don't stop me, and you're popular enough. There's no reason why you cannot win the votes of the people and become the next president. It's free and fair. However, how does it translate to some of us in the third world? We take it that, oh, if the son of that man, that former president, can become the president, then I can begin to nurture my son to also take over. Go and do your homework. No. I know my colleagues are not too happy with what I'm saying, but but I'm not saying that this is what you find all over the place. But the point is that you begin to set a pattern and a tone that makes it easier for others to want to take the cue from your situation. But of course, he made it through money. I mean, the more money you have, I presume, the more you can harness the democratic electoral process to your advantage. Now, there are some who would say, well, fair enough, I don't have the money, but I have the bullet, or I have the gun, or I have other means. I'm not saying that we should be doing that, but the point is, You have the money at your disposal, and if that, you can use that to get into office, others can use other means. So, in effect, it for those of us in Africa, as we watch this, it was ringing an old music of nepotism. Nepotism is when you're creating room for your relations, you know, to take positions, etc., or your tribal groups, etc., to begin, and you begin to position them, etc. I can cite a few places, but I will not. It'll be, you know, yes. it'll only create a complication for me. However, the point I want to make is that I think with the demise of the old man, and much as we disagreed, I mean, we got along. And I don't think it's fair for his son to want to take over from his father. But that's quite understandable, because having built and sustained and survived in government using an ethnic army out of which you've created, one ethnic group out of which you've created an ethnic army, your only survival means that you would have to find somebody closest to him or the next person to take over that institution. No, don't stop me yet. I'll finish. So, and that's what he did. Fortunately, the world brought pressure to bear, and the young man, thankfully, you know, withdrew. Now, how can we put into place a mechanism that will ensure a free and fair election that would not, you know, give an advantage to his ethnic group, okay? Because his ethnic group actually are the ones who are carrying the gun. But I'm hoping that he would have matured enough to see that the future, the beauty of what lies ahead, the peace and stability, you know, that lies ahead, can only come by putting aside the gun and giving, you know, an opportunity to every ethnic group in that country to have a free and fair election. And quite frankly, this can only happen not just from those of us in West Africa. We do not have the capacity, yes, to do that alone. America will have to get involved. The European Union will have to get involved. France will have to play her part. Otherwise, we will only have a repetition of the old legacy. And quite frankly, this does not augur well for the future. And if they get away with it, others will not see why they shouldn't do the same things. You see what I mean? Thank you. But quite frankly, madam, I think he will do what is right. Yes.
The prompt answer of the African Union is a sign of maturity of our continent, that we are ready to take our own responsibilities. And this is in the case of Togo, but it was also in the case of the other conflicts, Liberia, and other, even Somalia, who thought 2 years ago that Somalia could have a parliament. Somalia can become a country again. It's because Africa has grown up. And this is something which people do not recognize. And you say, conflicts in Africa. Why don't we speak about the conflicts in the Middle East? Did you have any oil company from America which withdrew from Middle East because there's conflict? Or because there is a dictatorship when the elections took place in Saudi Arabia? Well, this is to complete that in Africa we have taken a decision. No more coup d'etats, no more seizure of power, by unconstitutional means, whether it's a coup d'etat or not. We want democracy, a real democracy, a participative democracy. It's not just democracy of vote. It's what you eat, what you wear, where do you live, what water you drink. It's democracy. Thank you.
Thank you. Everyone wanted to speak. I'm going to start with President Mwinyi, and I'll let you all speak. Just a second.
Complete the presentation.
Young people, good evening. I was young democracies in Africa. And as such, we are going through the teething problems of being young. I'm sure this is a passing phase, hopefully before very long. Everything, or a lot of things, will be quite in order. I wanted to chip in.
Excellency President Hoffman,
correct? Yes, I just wanted to give an example, very short one. People talk about violence, people talk about no democracy in Africa. But we, 10 of us who is in front of you, is it exact answer to that question?
I'm going to try to take some questions from the floor.
Thank you. The question I wanted to ask tonight is, all of you are young countries. You haven't been independent very long, especially when you think of this country and our independence in 350 years, 400 years. We haven't really gotten it together yet either. My question is, is it just about the economics of it, or the question is, who is going to be responsible for saving Africa for Africa? Because the interest, the money, the economy, as soon as it comes in, your resources, your culture, your way of life, it's going to change unless you... My proposal is, what leadership or what kinds of thinking and philosophies and getting together has occurred and will continue to occur to make sure that other interests, other world interests who have good intentions but come in and take over, and the Africans lose their culture, lose what they have right now that is so special.
President, would you like to take that, Your Excellency?
Madam Chair, Africa's problems... It is true, we need assistance from outside for solutions. But nothing can be done, nothing can be resolved without the people themselves being at the center. African problems will be resolved, I have no doubt about that. Look at the slave trade. It came. It was resolved. Look at the colonial problem. Africa was parceled out, as we all know. It has been resolved. Apartheid in South Africa. It has been resolved. It's gone. Now we are fighting HIV and AIDS, a problem which has come. I'm confident we're going to resolve it. We need the support of outside, but in the main, these problems, as in the past, will be resolved by the African people themselves. So Africa's future is assured. It's assured. Many problems, yes. But please, look at this desk, Madam Chair. Look at the people in front here. When did you first see a lineup of retirees like this? They have retired. They stood. Some were defeated. Some retired. And they are still serving Africa. 12 of them. Tomorrow there will be 13. Two more are coming. So you see, this is a big change.
Yes, it is.
And let us recognize it as change for the better.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
One more question.
Your Excellencies, my name is Martin Owino from African Health Foundation. There are two things which really gets us down. One of them you have solved already by getting out of the driving seat to where you are now. You deserve an African clap. So, ladies and gentlemen, when I say one, you give them only one. To His Excellencies, one. Now, my question is, Africa is only 10% of the world population. We host 2/3 of HIV/AIDS infection. Every day, 6,000 sub-Saharan Africans die with this disease. My foundation is trying to mobilize all Africans to go and help back home. But the problem I want to ask you is, as I run back and forth, the source of infection is heterosexual. The factors which drives that is the imbalance of gender power. Mm. And as we talk, now, the UNAIDS have singled out women and girls as the prime victims for this disease. Now, as elders, as former presidents, and as statesmen, how can we balance the gender power between men and women so that when a lady says no, she can still stay at home and eat?
Madam Chair, that is an extremely important question. Like that young man, I'm running an organization called the Kenneth Kaunda Children of Africa Foundation, Fighting AIDS. It's not an easy thing at all. It is an extremely difficult problem. Some of the programs we are undertaking in my foundation are opposed by some church leaders. For example, I can tell the audience, Madam Chair, that I lost a son, my wife and I lost a son to AIDS, 1986, December 23. He was 30. Left 6 children and a wife. After burying, put him to rest, my wife and I decided to help fight AIDS by fighting these prejudices around the disease. So I called a press conference and made it clear my son, our son, had died of HIV/AIDS. I formed this foundation, Kenneth Kaunda Children of Africa Foundation, and began fighting this disease. Because I made that public, in order to fight the prejudices against the disease, I've been invited to various parts of the world to talk about this. I said, remember, prevention is better than cure. What does this mean? It means abstinence, keeping away from sex. But I went further to say, if you can't keep away from sex as a matter of discipline, self-discipline, then use condoms. Male condoms, female condoms. When I said this, Madam Chair, I was condemned by some church leaders who said I was an evil man, I was promoting evil things. In a reply, I said this. Some of the people I know who have died of AIDS were pastors, were reverends, were fathers, were sisters. If you had allowed them to use those condoms, they might be alive today. They might be allowed today, and they would give you a chance to help them spiritually recover. Now they are 6 feet down. You can't help them. They are finished. I said, go out there and get tested. Get tested. Whether you are a man or woman, find out your own condition. Leaders must give, lead by example. Leaders, teachers, policemen, police officers, soldiers, priests, politicians like myself must go out there and get tested. I'm not telling you what I didn't do. I went out there and got tested. I said, even if I had been found negative, positive, I would have said so publicly. That would have helped me to continue this fight. I'm negative, but I'm still saying go out there and get tested. Find out what your condition is. If we don't do these things, these mothers we're talking about will not be protected. We have to do these things, get tested, create conditions, places where people can go and get tested. This is how we fight HIV/AIDS. If we run away from this truth, we have no chance at all. Now, the area where we come from, most of us here, is the most infected area. Millions of our people have died. And AIDS is not choosing. It's not saying women only or men only at all. Experts tell us between 15 and 40, around 40 age group, which is suffering most. In Zambia, Madam Chair, when we took over government control, we found only 100 university graduates in 70 years of British rule. 100 university graduates. Only three of these were medical doctors. We invested our money from COPA wisely. And by the time we left office, there were more than 35,000 graduates in Zambia. Today, because of AIDS, a good number of these are gone. They've died. Money invested wisely, money lost. Because of these conditions, terrible conditions we're having now, most of those have died, graduates. Even nurses now, well trained in thousands, a good number of them are in Britain, a good number of them are in America, in Europe. They've gone to Australia. These are some of the problems we face because of AIDS, HIV/AIDS. But we need your assistance. We need your help. Stick to the truth, and the truth will help us. In the end, I can tell you, I'm confident. Good Lord is great, God Almighty. I'm confident as we defeated slave trade, as we defeated colonialism, apartheid, we are going to defeat, in the name of God, HIV AIDS.
Thank you. And I am sure that I speak for the women in Africa and all the women over the world. Long overdue, but thank you very much. We would expect and appreciate that. We thank you so much for this challenging but optimistic conversation about the continent. Have a good evening, everyone.
You've been listening to the third annual African Presidential Roundtable Public Forum, hosted by Boston University's African Presidential Archives and Research Center. This year's symposium featured former African heads of state discussing a range of issues impacting U.S.-Africa relations and followed closed-door talks on the subjects. Moderating tonight's discussion was longtime Boston TV news anchor Liz Walker. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and George Hicks, with help from Glenn Alexander. Our web producer is Angel Cuzzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.